Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go.
Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with co-host Alan Phillips. Today is October 28, 2010, and you're listening to show number 2, our second show on vaccinations and your rights in the United States of America. And I would like to thank everyone who has been promoting this show. We've had lots of listeners just on the first show. It's very exciting. And don't forget, you can post your comments on the Blog Talk Radio website. You can join the Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. group on Homeopathy World Community if you are a member. And we will continue with this very pertinent contemporary issue about legal rights and health freedom in America. Alan, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Debbie. How about yourself?
Doing great. I'm ready to learn some, to go into law school with you is basically how I feel it's going to be when we learn about legal precedent today and what you've started to teach me a little bit about substantive and non-substantive part of the law, which sounds like maybe gobbledygook to some people, and we don't want to turn them off. So we're going to bring them in slowly by maybe doing just a little bit of a wrap-up of what we learned last week about the different areas of the different areas where people would enter the complexities of the rights to refuse vaccines for either the school, the medical, philosophical, religious, or any other kind of exemption. I think that might be a good way just to start.
Sure, Debbie. And it's sort of interesting because when I started this work, I had no real concept of how broad and vast and in some ways deep it is legally. There are over a dozen different arenas in the U.S. where the question, how do I legally avoid vaccines, comes up. And so schools, for example, public schools, private schools, homeschoolers, military schools, colleges, college programs that have that are healthcare related, that have requirements of clinical work in local hospitals or healthcare facilities, each of these are legally distinct different areas that can have different law that applies. Now, there's also some law, and we'll get into this talking about legal precedent, that is common to each of these areas as well. There's also military, but not just military members, military families, and I mentioned military schools already, civilian contractors for the military. Again, each of these different areas can have different law that applies, and so is legally a distinct arena. We have immigration. Immigrants are required to get vaccines, and that includes foreign adoptions. If you're not immigrating, but you want to adopt a child from overseas, you've got to deal with the same immigration waiver procedure. And, of course, a really big area that you and I have talked about, and I think we'll be talking about this one over time, the recent flood of requirements in hospitals and healthcare facilities around the country mandating that the employees, nurses and otherwise, get the seasonal and swine flu vaccines, if not also other vaccines, or lose their jobs. And so that's also a distinctly different area that has different law that applies. So many different arenas or areas or contexts in which the question comes up, and each of them ultimately has its own unique parts and pieces legally.
That is why it's so important to not think that you can handle it yourself, not think that you can just get on the internet and scour the internet and find forms that you could fill out, but really speak to somebody who has dealt specifically with these different applications, that different areas that people might need help to know exactly what to do in their individual case. And that's why it's really good to have your ebook and contact with you. Even if you can't help them, you know other people, because you've been so out there in the last number of years dealing with this issue very specifically.
Now, just real quick, to be sure, there are some areas, some schools, for example, some states that have forms, and really all you need to do to exercise an exemption to routine immunizations is sometimes to sign a form or check a box or something fairly simple and straightforward, and of course nobody needs to hire an attorney to do that. But in the several states and federal contexts where, in particular, where with religious objections, you're tasked with putting out, justifying your exemption claim or request by stating what your beliefs are. That's an arena where there are a lot of pitfalls. And mm-hmm. exemptions have been on the rise in recent years, generally. And so authorities who oppose exemptions and the exercise of exemptions are looking for ways to deal with that. And so they, in many contexts and situations, are putting more pressure on people on the front line, so to speak, on an individual level, to try to discourage people or to come up with reasons to reject or refuse exemption claims. And so it's real important how you put those things together if you have to do something more or other than just sign a form or check a box.
Yeah, so it depends on where you live and what the guidelines, the rules, and the laws are in your state in America. And are there changes to these state rules and regulations that are going on to make it more difficult in some way?
Well, law is changing all the time, and so we have to monitor it. I have been of the impression generally that over the years, philosophical exemptions have come and gone in different states. So we have to be mindful of that, but it's just looking at the statutes and regulations. While that's a necessary starting point at the state level for state exemptions, school exemptions, at the federal level for military and immigration and U.S. territories, it's a necessary starting point, but it's only part of the picture. The statutes and regulations seldom, if ever, give you the complete scope of the rights. What are the boundaries? And for, in particular, for religious exemptions, and generally, by the way, what qualifies for religious exemptions is really broad. But again, there are also pitfalls. It's not an open-ended right. So how do we know what the boundaries are? And that takes us into a discussion of legal precedent, because we have in our legal system this massive compilation of statutes, regulations, constitutional provisions at both state and federal levels. But in one sense, our legal system attempts to do something that, at least on the first layer of the analysis, is impossible to do, in the sense that to the extent that a, let's say, statute, for example, would pretend or purport to be clear for the hypothetically infinite variety of specific situations that might arise under any given statute, I mean, that's just an impossible task. So many times you have a situation that comes up and it's really clear how the law applies to it because it just is obvious, you know, on the face of it. Stop at a red light. Okay, when you get to the red light, you stop. Although even that one is not as clear, as simple
because
as it first seems.
Yeah, there's exceptions to every rule that we might be able to turn on a red light if we look and see it's clear.
Or what if you have an emergency? If someone's bleeding to death in the back seat, I think our law would allow that person to go through the red light. But what if they're not in a life-threatening situation? You know, where would the line be drawn? Reasonable people would draw that line in different places. So even in something as simple as stopping at a red light, we can turn it into a complex discussion of where boundaries should be under certain situations. So if you have something that's an inherently complex issue to begin with, it's even all the more, at least potentially, complicated. So the question then
I
of how
see how
a statute,
it can get quite it can get quite complex based on this little analogy that you've provided for us, and not thinking that, you know, it's simple and clear cut, black and white, red light, stop, green light, go, but, and, you know, yellow, caution. So really, there is a lot for us to learn here. Are you going to tell us about that substantive stuff?
I will get into that. And what I'm trying to do, Debbie, let me be clear, because people will be asking at some point, what does that have to do with, you know, exercising a vaccine exemption? And my purpose here is to give just a brief introduction to the inherent complexity of law, because it's really important for people to understand. For example, when do I need an attorney? There are many times when you don't, and nobody has ever legally required an attorney that I know of, seldom if ever, required to hire an attorney to exercise a legal right. It's really a more purely practical question. And if you understand, have some understanding about the inherent complexity of the law and the legal system, you're better equipped to recognize when you might really need or benefit from having an attorney. So, you know, that's part of the answer to why we'll take some time today to give really some background on the law generally as much as talking about specifics of vaccine rights. So we'll do both. So you have, let's say, a statute that says if you have, like we have here in North Carolina, that says, I'm paraphrasing, if you have sincerely held religious belief opposed to immunizations, you are exempt. And you say, great, well, what is a sincerely held religious belief legally? Does it matter if you belong to an organized religion? Does it matter which one you belong to if you do? What if you've had vaccines in the past? Can you still exercise a legal exemption now? There's a whole range of questions that can come up that aren't answered by the statute. And so when we want to get more information about how a statute might apply to a specific situation, we have to look to legal precedent. Legal precedent is rulings in court cases that judges in those courts that are empowered to do so, they have the option when they rule on a case to produce what they call a published legal opinion that then serves as legal precedent or a point of reference in the law that then cases and attorneys and courts can look to in the future as a point of reference. Where legal precedent gets complicated, among other ways, I'm sure, are two areas. One is that sometimes the facts in a particular case that is legal precedent are related to the facts in a current situation, but they're not the same. And so there can be some question about if or how the precedent applies to this situation. And in law, precedent can apply at times because the facts are similar, or it can apply analogously. So there is some creativity possible there. You can have, depending on what the particular point of law is that is in question, you might have a legal precedent case where the facts in that case were completely different from the facts in your case, but it may still have some application and tell the courts or serve as one side's legal argument for how the court should rule on an issue. So, but the short piece for our purposes today is to understand that to understand the full range of rights to the extent that they are defined at any given time with regard to vaccine exemptions and waivers, you need to look at both the law, the statute or regulation, and the legal precedent. So, for example, we know from some federal court precedent that it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion or which one you belong to if you do. What matters is what is your personally held religious belief. Now, that's a generalization because the way that precedent applies depends on what court it came from and where you live, what judicial district you are in. So, for example, there's a whole series of federal court cases, mostly out of New York federal district courts, that have helped define the boundaries for vaccine religious exemptions. However, those decisions are not binding on jurisdictions outside of New York. Generally speaking, precedent is only binding on the jurisdiction of the court it came from. So if precedent comes from the North Carolina State Supreme Court, it's only binding on North Carolina. The rest of the country can agree or disagree with it. Courts in the rest of the country can follow it or not. Most of the legal precedent concerning vaccine religious exemptions comes from New York federal district courts. It's not binding on the rest of the country. Now, that's the technical reality. The practical reality is that states around the country have been following that precedent. So while it's not a guarantee, absolutely, it's a really good indication of what the law is or would be if issues in other states, the same issues in other states came up in courts in other states. So I hope that's clear
that's
and not confusing.
That's really quite fascinating, and I'm wondering, would a person choose to live in a particular state depending on what the laws are and how much they want to deal with this issue? And it's also, strangely enough, because I'm a homeopath and I was listening to the words that you said, that if and when the precedent applies because they are similar or analogous, it really brings, because the way my mind is working, likes cures likes, and the foundation of homeopathy, and how all of this is sort of another layer of universal law.
Yeah, it makes me wonder.
I don't know whether you've understood anything of what I just said.
Oh, no, I think I did. I think it suggests that attorneys might make good homeopaths, but and vice versa, but if I understood correctly. But there's one really interesting example in the vaccine arena that I want to do just to underscore that last point a little bit further, because what that means, the idea of the application of precedent, depends on the jurisdiction of the court that it comes from. We have, of course, one federal constitution for the whole country, but we can have different rights under that constitution depending on how local courts interpret it differently. So I'll give you one dramatic example. The Mississippi State Supreme Court, in other words, it only applies to the state of Mississippi. The Mississippi State Supreme Court, a little over 30 years ago, ruled that vaccine religious exemptions are unconstitutional. They violate the federal constitution. No other state has issued a similar or same ruling. So, but the result is that in Mississippi, it's unconstitutional to have a vaccine religious exemption. That is, the state legislature there cannot even, you could have every member of the state legislature in favor of it. If they tried to pass it, it would be dead on arrival because it's not constitutional there. It's constitutional in every other state.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
now, what happened in Mississippi that they went all the way the other way in the interpretation of the law?
Well, for if I remember correctly, and this is going to be an approximation, but the court decided there, in the context of mainstream views on vaccination, that it was an infringement on the rights of others for somebody with a religious objection to refuse vaccines for religious reasons. It put other people at risk or something to that effect. So that was deemed by that court at that time to be a violation of others' constitutional rights. You know, how dare you try to use your religion to put other people at risk, you know, or to cause harm to other people, I think was sort of the gist of it. I'd have to reread it again to be more precise on that point. But it's interesting, though, and confusing, frankly, from a kind of common sense point of view. We have one federal constitution. How can we have different rights under it in different places? And the fact is,
true,
we can. So West Virginia also doesn't have, it's the only other state that doesn't have a vaccine religious exemption, but the reason they don't have one there is only because they can't get one passed, not because it's unconstitutional there. So let me jump, if I may, real quick to a brief introduction, because I know time is flying here, to the substantive and non-substantive law. And this, again, is just some general information that helps people to understand the inherent complexity of the legal system and hopefully can help them to factor in when they're deciding if and when they need an attorney, you know, really for any issue in this sense. But, of course, we're trying to apply this to exemptions and waivers. Legal disputes have both what are referred to as substantive law and non-substantive law components. Now, substantive law refers to the part that we all think about. You know, if you were to go to court for a vaccine religious exemption, say you applied for an exemption and your school rejected it and you took them to court, the substantive law issue is what is your right there? What is your First Amendment right? Because if it's a religious exemption, and what is your state right because it's a state law, and so forth. Non-substantive law refers to rules, procedures, remedies in law, basically how the substantive law issues are managed by the legal system. And let me give you some examples. For example, there are rules of procedure. They're different for civil court and criminal court. There are rules of court. There are rules of evidence. There are ethical rules for attorneys. Each one of these is a separate body of law, not just a list of codes or rules or laws in a straightforward sense, but just like substantive law issues, each of these has a body of legal precedent, an ever-growing, changing body of legal precedent that tells us how these specific rules apply in particular situations. And so when we look at really any substantive or non-substantive law component, law is a sort of a living organism in a sense that it's continually evolving. Sometimes the statute or regulation or even a constitutional provision is stricken or revised or modified and so forth. But the legal precedent that tells us how all of these laws or rules apply to specific situations is continually growing as well as new situations come up that become formal legal conflicts and that some of which inevitably become part of the legal precedent. And so we never know in an absolute sense what the boundaries of our rights are. What we know is what those boundaries are to the extent that the legal precedent has defined it for us. And as new precedent comes up, we get further clarification on the boundaries of our rights. And, of course, precedent can at times overrule prior precedent. And so sometimes precedent helps refine and clarify our understanding, and sometimes it changes it completely. And in rare instances, the courts will interpret a statute or regulation to mean something completely different than what it actually looks like when you just read it. Now, that's unusual, but I have actually seen that happen in at least one case with a statute here in North Carolina. So, again, while the statutes and regulations are starting points, they really are only that if you want to understand the boundaries and scope of your rights.
So I'm understanding that these precedents help to define what the boundaries are in, and they may be different in the federal courts, in state courts, and we as individuals in the public who are actually living human beings with these laws, restrictions, and dealing with our own mindset about vaccinations, of how we view them in our lives, can make a difference in changing the laws, in moving them in one direction or another. I'm just imaging like an amoeba. Like it's not a box. It's not something with lines and strict regulations, but it's more amorphous that can be changed based on who's listening and who's involved and who has a situation in their life that might change their perception of what vaccinations mean and how they interact in society, whether it is as Mississippi has ruled so strict that it's practically not able to have an exemption based on what you just said. Am I correct with the way I'm reading what you've explained?
Well, to the extent that legal precedent and it is a, in a sense, a living entity in that it's, so maybe as an analogy, we think of languages as being dead or alive sometimes, where the English language is alive because we're continually adding new words to it and new figures of speech and so forth. And mm-hmm. legal precedent is similar. Whenever a new situation comes up and that goes through the system to a point where it can, and if it then does become legal precedent, then we have further refined or clarified our understanding of that area of the law. But for the most part, when judges are ruling, you know, it's at least theoretically, it's not an arbitrary decision on their part as to what they want or like. They are doing their best effort to interpret and apply the law in the appropriate way to whatever the situation is. Now, obviously, there are situations and circumstances where judges could disagree. And part of what feeds the ever-growing body of legal precedent for any given area of law is the emergence of new situations in formal legal disputes where there isn't legal precedent you can point to and say, here's how you resolve that. And so there may be a very legitimate arguments on two or more sides as to how the law should be applied to this new situation that has never come up, at least in the court system, formally before. And so I'm the point, I guess, is I'm not sure whether or not in what you said there was an implication of some element of arbitrariness. And while ultimately I think that's unavoidable, I think for the most part, you know, judges are looking to say, how is this supposed to be interpreted in this situation, and we're going to apply the law that way.
I don't think I was talking about arbitrariness. I'm saying that the courts and the judges are reflecting the body of evidence and the life situations of their domain, of the people in their district. I mean, if somebody comes to them with a case of, you know, and there's like a whole neighborhood that is affected by a certain batch of vaccines or something that was tainted, then it's going to bring to the foreground something that's going to perhaps move the direction of interpretation of the law in a new direction.
Theoretically, at least in the... you know, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, may factor in policy, public policy, more heavily and more frequently maybe than some of the lower courts. But I think what they try to do, it's their, you know, their job anyway, is not to be influenced by the way they think it should come out, but to look at how does a strict analytical interpretation of current law say that it has to come out. And it may or may not comport with what their personal opinion is.
Okay. Do you want to just wrap up and tell us, you know, the main theme of what it is that we learned today? And we really have only a minute left. I'm probably going to have to put the music on.
Okay. Well, I've enjoyed being here. Thanks for having me. And just cut me off whenever you need to. And we'll go into some more of the precedent rulings for vaccine exemptions next time. And that'll be more the kind of meat of this in terms of what's really important to your listeners. But in essence, the legal system, I believe, mirrors in its complexity the complexity of our society. We have an enormously complex society, and so the legal system necessarily, I think, is inherently complex. And again, I'm not saying this to try to confuse people or certainly not to scare them about the complexity of the legal system, but to help you understand that there are some inherent complexities. And so when you understand that you are or may be dealing with some of those complexities, that's a good time to be looking for further information. And then there's lots of detail about everything we talk about today in the ebook that's available on the Homeopathy World Community website. So I would absolutely refer people to the ebook there for more in-depth explanation of these topics.
Perfect. That's great, Alan. I'm looking forward to the next show. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Journeys can be begin, so they do as we bring out the wisdom from within. Share your light, let your peace be of earth. Walk by walk, we are reaching the world. We see the world. But now we look with strength renewed and more ability to find our true expression. Allow our souls to shine, bringing forth a grace of love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be your truth. One by one, we are changed. To make a lasting difference, we can't do passively. It takes an act of loving will to cause a change to be. So light your inner candle and ever guard its flame. As its radiance grows brighter, to the world it will proclaim. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one, we are freeing the world. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One.